KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Charge of Microsoft says he's leaving. Steve Ballmer announced he'd retire sometime in the next year, and Microsoft stock prices started heading up. That's today's big story, but a lot went on this week in our region. And joining us to talk about the week's news, our regular panel of journalists, alphabetically, Joni Balter, assistant political editor at the Seattle Times, Knute Berger, Mossback at Crosscut.com, and Eli Sanders, associate editor for The Stranger. Nice to see all three of you again.
Good morning.
Who was surprised that Steve Ballmer's leaving his job? Anybody? No. They all say no.
How about no? I wasn't surprised. I'd been hearing about this for some time. Wall Street seemed to like it a bit, do you think? 5% of
ten,
the stock?
Yeah, 10.
Is up. Oh, is it now 10?
Yeah.
Okay, at last check, it wasn't. So very interesting. So Microsoft, you know, has sort of become a little bit like the company it wasn't supposed to be, IBM. It's become sort of slow and stodgy and trying to find its next place. The wording that was used in the announcement, the idea that Microsoft is now wants to become a successful devices and services company, got some attention in the business blogs quite a bit about, you know, they're finally saying they're not really all about software and that this was a big deal and that, you know, how is this going to go? So Steve Ballmer leaving, you know, it is a big deal. We don't know where he's going. We don't know how fast he's leaving. They hired a company, one of those headhunters whose name I love, Heidrick and Struggles, to find somebody to replace him. I remember that's the firm that found John Stanford many years ago to be the Seattle school superintendent. Just a weird asterisk, if you don't mind. And so, you know, maybe Microsoft will move a little quicker, you know, under some new kind of younger, more modern leadership.
You think so, Eli?
We'll see. It's interesting that they don't have that new leadership, you know, groomed and ready to go. Ballmer says this is his choice and he, you know, is leaving on his own terms, but also at the same time that this is earlier than he wanted to leave. He wanted to guide the company through this long transition, he was saying, to the what is the language? The device services company?
Yes, services and devices.
Devices and services.
Yeah. Devices and services. So it seems to me he wasn't wanting to leave at this moment, and obviously they didn't have someone lined up to step in.
Well, this morning on our Morning Edition show, Bill Radke spoke with Todd Bishop of GeekWire, who said on our air that in fact, Ballmer had discouraged any kind of succession plan. I don't know that that's true, but I think it's an interesting observation about his power at that company.
Well, you've had, you know, two dynamic leaders at that company, Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer, and a lot of the most successful executives over the years have been grown from within the company. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that there isn't somebody that's been groomed to sort of manage that transition. So, I mean, he'll be there for up to a year, sounds like, and the fact that they're doing a search suggests that they're possibly looking at bringing in somebody with a new set of skills and a new, can reorient the company. I mean, they just went through the kind of big reorganization to make it more this devices and services
yeah.
company.
Let's all say it together.
Yeah, right. It's the phrase. It was interesting is the company has never done so well as when it was Gates and Ballmer. Mm-hmm. They seem to work really well together. In talking with people who've worked closely with both of them, there's that that way in which Gates had marketing brilliance, but also the kind of technological vision that really drove the company. And Ballmer was the sort of the engine for the marketing, sales, and corporate cheerleading side.
Well, let's just talk about technology and vision, because the company has been limping. I know that the shareholders believe that, and today they're probably really happy. But the Windows Phone and the Surface Tablet, which were both late attempts to try to catch up with both Apple and Android, have been, unsuccessful. They've barely made a scratch, a dent in the market at all.
You can measure it firsthand from standing at University Village and looking at all the people running into the Apple store on one side of the street or parking lot and the kind of tumbleweeds blowing past the Microsoft store that they just put up.
Wait a minute. But on the day that that store opened, I had just happened to be there, and there were a bunch of young folks outside sort of creating this crowd, and I didn't know if that was promotional or organic.
Well, if Steve Ballmer is a marketing genius, maybe he was good at least making some kind of hustle.
Well, I think they've also, a stagnant Microsoft is better than a lot of companies doing their best during this last decade. So, and they certainly have had some successes. Xbox would be an example. So it's not like they don't have incredible capabilities. To me, one of the interesting things is the fact that we tend to get attached to companies, especially big companies that have changed our culture. Boeing is a great example. But, your father's Boeing is not the Boeing of today. They're no longer headquartered in Seattle, and they made changes. It's interesting to consider what kinds of changes might be coming up for Microsoft. We're relying on these tech companies now that are in a market that is changing rapidly. So you see suddenly Amazon is a player in areas that it's never been a player in before.
Mm-hmm.
Microsoft is stumbling in areas where other people are not. I think, things are just very fluid and you have to adapt constantly. And I think that's got to be a big part of what this is about.
In an email this morning, Michael Parks, who is a longtime business observer and reporter,
been on the show before,
and a regular guest on Weekday, said that Microsoft tried to bury this news by releasing it on a Friday in August, and that it didn't really work. And I would assume that Friday, August, summer. What do you think?
Sometimes that works, but sometimes when there's no other news on that Friday in August, guess what? It becomes the biggest.
It was
someone I was talking to pointed out this morning, they said, usually when you release this kind of news on Friday, it's because you think it was bad news, but the stock market thought it was good news. So maybe they should have released it on Monday and they would have seen even bigger growth next week.
Monday's your best day for rolling news along like that.
Have any of you heard from any Microsoft workers, any gauge of how folks are taking it at the company? Nope.
No, but a lot of them are probably also invested in the company, so they must be pleased at how the stock market reacted.
I think that would be, the last I saw it had dropped a little bit from the 10% increase, but it could be changing as we speak right now. I don't have the stock ticker right in front of me on the computer. Well, speaking of buried news, Mayor McGinn this week released contents of an independent review of the economic impact of the coal trains on the city, which was kind of a balanced good news and bad news. And the big question was why he waited several weeks to release this.
Primary election, something like that.
Yeah, it's totally politics.
Anybody hear that one?
Although I'm confused, I understand theoretically the politics of waiting because of the primary, but actually this report had some bad news regarding coal trains, and so I'm not sure why the mayor was soft playing it.
Well, it was a very balanced report. On the one hand, some amount of jobs will be created. On the other hand, there's going to be wait times and lost wages from people
sitting there. Yeah, you might relocate the downtown fire station. There's a lot for McGinn, who's an opponent of coal trains, to point to in the study and say, this is another reason we shouldn't allow this to happen. And so it's almost it's actually one of the most unfortunate plays he could make, because it frustrates the people who want to see him, his base, in other words, who want to see him aggressively standing up to coal trains.
It was interesting. Meanwhile, the other interesting news, and the mayor is back in full force. There's a
press release a day or more.
A minute.
He's joined forces with Washington's ceasefire to sort of sign up local businesses that want to ban patrons from bringing guns into their private businesses, which they have the right to do under the law. He tried to ban guns in city parks.
Mayor Greg Nichols tried to ban the guns in city parks.
Right. I mean, that idea is illegal. So, we're working on the legal thing. It brings up so many questions. If we're talking about the political ramifications of a coal train report, what are the political ramifications of banning gun carriage, if that's the right verb or noun.
Well, it's a symbolic, basically largely symbolic issue. The argument is that because of the way state law is and the way the legislature is unwilling to act on gun control, you can't do a lot more than acts that are symbolic. Mm. Individual private businesses can ban gun owners from coming in, even though carrying a gun is a legal right. They can tell you to wear shoes and a shirt and that kind of thing, too. So this is something that will highlight the city's commitment to some kind of gun control effort. But there's no – it's kind of like the gun buyback, I mean, in the sense that will it really have a tangible effect? Probably not. But will it raise people's consciousness and get people thinking about the issue? And what will be interesting is to see whether it has any effect in the actual market. Will businesses find that putting up a gun-free sticker in their window is good for business, like putting up a Best of Seattle sticker? Or will it be kind of ho-hum? I mean, I think, you know, I certainly don't choose to go into a business whether or not somebody's, you know, carrying a gun in their purse.
Well, and that was my other question. I mean, are you going to frisk people at the dorm? You could put up a sign. But
I think it means to visibly bring a gun in, because how else in the world would you know? And don't forget, this followed this week the Starbucks event, where people who do have guns were able to go to Starbucks.
Which is all about the open carry
right.
movement.
And there's actually a protest tomorrow against the Starbucks. You know, I personally haven't seen a lot of open carry weaponry in Seattle. Am I just frequenting the wrong establishments?
Or the right ones.
Or the right ones. You know, I think
this is sort of a problem that's not that big, you know, not that ever present, but it is symbolic, and it generated probably the kind of news that McGinn wouldn't mind.
Well, although gun control is a problem that is ever present, and I think this is another example of McGinn is very good at taking a step or throwing a punch that provokes a response that he's predicted that allows him to then throw another punch that really shuts down the conversation in a way that's good for him. So, and we talked about this last week, this dynamic between him and Ed Murray. So McGinn did this. Murray put out a statement that said, well, this is symbolic and not very much of anything to solve the bigger problem. And McGinn, obviously ready for that, came right back and said, yeah, the bigger problem lies with the state. And Ed Murray has been in the state legislature for this long.
And you haven't done this.
It did have the feel of a ping pong match. So if I hit this one, then if other folks will hit back, then Ed Murray will say this is largely symbolic. And then the gun group will come back and say, yeah, but you're in the state Senate.
Well,
what are you doing?
That argument, too. Only goes so far. I mean, Democrats, a huge number of Democrats are opposed the gun legislation that came up. So this is not just those Eastern Washington Republicans. There's a bipartisan block, and the and it's one of those just as if I were Ed Murray, I'd say, you know, just as I worked on gay marriage over time, I have worked on the gun issue over time, will continue to do so, because it's not something that's going to happen overnight, and that's not Ed Murray's fault.
But the reason McGinn wants to have this conversation is it goes right at Murray's supposed strength, which is his ability to get things done with people across aisles, which is, you know, his implicit criticism of McGinn that he can't work with other people.
But it's fascinating to watch. Like Joni said, it is sort of a ping pong match. Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Knute Berger, I'm Marcy Silman. We'll continue our discussion of the week in review here on KUOW.
It's 10:20. Good morning. I'm Guy Nelson, and it's 67 degrees in Seattle's University District. We'll continue with our news panel in just a minute and have them weigh in on the news events of the week here on 94.9 News and Information.
Starting on September 3rd, it's The Record on KUOW.
Inspiration from music, arts, and culture.
Smart analysis of national and global issues.
News and stories that matter about Seattle and the Puget Sound region.
I'm Ross Reynolds.
And I'm Marcy Silman. Join us and Steve Scher.
Starting September 3rd, The Record spins every weekday from noon to 2.
Hope you can join us.
We do hope you can join us. And the Friday News Panel will continue as part of that program every Friday morning at 10 o'clock. 67 degrees in Seattle. It's cloudy right now. We'll have some sunshine this afternoon with a high of 75 degrees. Cloudy overnight. Tomorrow cloudy with a chance of showers, high 73. Damien Echols spent years on death row as one of the West Memphis Three convicted in the murders of three schoolboys. He walked free a year ago following an HBO documentary pointing out flaws in the case and a public campaign that attracted Eddie Vedder, Johnny Depp, and other celebrities. Echols shares his story with us in the noon hour here on KUOW this morning. It's 1021. This is KUOW.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. This is the Week in Review here on KUOW with our regular panel of journalists, Knute Berger, editor-at-large of Seattle Magazine, the Mossback at Crosscut, Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger, Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. And we were talking about ceasefire, pairing up with the mayor of Seattle to at least put stickers on establishments that don't want guns. And Joni, you said in the break there that you had the perfect
My segue comes from Ballmer to the next story.
Okay, Steve Ballmer, who also announced his retirement, yes.
My segue comes from there to the Chris Hansen story.
Chris Hansen, yeah.
He had sort of a rough week, Chris Hansen did,
yes.
Self-caused. And the idea is possibly that now that Chris Hansen sort of got himself in trouble with this donation to the ballot issue down in Sacramento, that perhaps maybe the more high-profile person in that group could become or would be
Steve Ballmer,
this guy that doesn't have work anymore, Steve Ballmer.
Well, let's recap that story. Chris Hansen, the main guy, the hedge fund guy who wants to bring a basketball team to Seattle, was caught by California state officials for donating secretly $100,000 to a group opposed to a new arena in Sacramento for the Kings basketball team. And what was illegal about that is that you have to declare when you make contributions to campaigns in California. And what I love, my favorite of the many critiques of this contribution was Seattle Times columnist Danny Wesney comparing Hansen to Karl Rove. Art Thiel compared him to Clay Bennett. You know, this so-called golden boy who, Knute, you wrote about as well, sort of managed to tarnish himself in one fell dip.
Well, it's the risk of doing something contrary to a very carefully established narrative. And the narrative here was, as I see it, was he made Seattle a kind of an offer it couldn't refuse, which was, I'm going to heal the wound of the Sonics having left, and it's not going to cost you anything. All, you know, if you give me a little bit of money, I'll pay it back, and then, you know, we'll have this nice new arena. And he is a local guy. You know, grew up in the Rainier Valley, basketball fan from way back, wanting to do something good for his hometown. He's a charming, you know, very nice seeming, perfect, you know, had the sort of the perfect presentation for Seattle. And then we find out there's been a series of missteps in terms of negotiations with the NBA and whatnot. But then we find out that, you know, he's making these secret campaign donations, which in this case, It was essentially after the fact. I mean, yes. Sacramento got the team, the NBA signed off, and then, you know, out of pique or whatever, you know, find that he's trying to sabotage the deal. And it looks bad because the whole argument has been, or not the whole argument, but a big part of the argument has been, well, we're going to make the best deal possible. This is a great guy. He's kind of not like those sleazy other sports owners that we've had.
But wait, he is.
And then you find out, well, he's not quite. We don't know that much, you know. He's made a lot of money hedge funding, and that's not a business that, you know, the Occupy Seattle folks would have a lot of respect for. So, anyway, it just interrupts a narrative that was sailing along fairly smoothly, and it puts the arena a little bit back in the politics, although I think both McGinn and Murray are going to want to avoid dealing with it.
The most surprising thing was the timing of it. In his argument when he got caught, Chris Hansen, was that he got caught up in the heat of battle. But what actually happened was this happened after the NBA said, we're going to Sacramento. And so whether this was just an inability to let go of that idea that he would have the Sacramento Kings or whatever, but it just that a check was written that far after is probably one of the key parts of this story.
Although if you rewind to that period, I remember a column from Danny Westing, and I love his columns, but I remember specifically at that time him saying, you know, man, it seems like Seattle's losing this game because we're too nice.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a number of people commenting on this. And so the Clay Bennett comparison actually in that context is not so bad. It's a guy who really wants something playing dirty in the way that Seattle perceives the NBA playing kind of not dirty, I guess.
Not on a fair court,
yeah.
I guess, not on a field.
I was trying not to mix metaphors.
Yeah, not football, it's basketball. But I thought Bruce Harrell had it right. I think he supports the arena deal. Where Bruce Harrell said, well, you know, you don't become as rich as Chris Hansen did by being such a nice guy. That's
by
only in movies.
Nice,
yeah, I mean, right. I think hedge fund managers, it's not Pollyanna. It's
well, and this just reaffirms that the onus on this whole thing is going to go back on the mayor,
mm-hmm.
go back on the city council, and particularly Tim Burgess, who took a out front position in saying, well, the mayor did, you know, got negotiated with Hansen, but the council made it better. I made it better. They're going to be on the hook for that. Ed Murray, if he wanted to, would have an opportunity to be more of an arena skeptic. He's unlikely to do that because a lot of business interests want it to happen, and I don't think he wants to get in the middle of it right now. to me, the funny thing was, from a political standpoint, the person in the last week or so that's looked good is Peter Steinbrück. Peter Steinbrück was the arena skeptic who specifically was questioning Hansen's motivations, Hansen's honesty in terms of saying this process wasn't transparent enough, we didn't know enough. And I thought it was also interesting that even the Seattle Times had an editorial saying Ed Murray should channel Peter Steinbrück, particularly on the issue of the port jobs and blue-collar jobs, which the arena is a potential threat to. And, of course, unfortunately, Peter didn't make it through the primary.
So
he's, I think, being proven right on this.
So how much tarnish does the mayor pick up from this? Chris Hansen's golden boy image is tarnished. Is this a temporary?
Well, the tarnish is does definitely accrue to the mayor, but it accrues to many others, as Skip was saying, because Tim Burgess was involved in this. Dal Constantine, the
right.
county executive,
yeah.
was involved in this. All the council members on both councils who voted for the new improved Tim Burgess deal have a connection to this. So it is in that way spread out. It has been interesting to watch Ed Murray in the race because he has said he's had comments, but they're not really like a position, like I'm for an mm-hmm. arena on such and such a date with a certain amount of public money or I'm against. It's been a very sort of gentle discussion of, yes, there might be an arena someday.
This was actually one of the stranger's frustrations with Ed Murray that we expressed in our endorsement of McGinn in the primary, mm-hmm. that he does have a lot of comments on things, but not clear positions on a number of Seattle centric topics that you would want the next mayor to be really weighing in clearly on. I don't quite know whether I agree with the idea of tarnish from Hansen's move. I come back to what I was saying before. I think that the people who are rabid basketball fans who want a team in the city and want an arena don't really care if he's, you know, throwing an elbow or playing a little dirty in the pursuit of that. I think they want what they want, and they understand this is a pretty messed up situation from Seattle's point of view, and that maybe you need to not be nice all the time.
Throwing elbow is the right metaphor
Thank
for basketball.
It is.
It is.
There.
Let's get the sports down.
The narrative, I think, will switch from, hey, what a great guy, to who is this guy? And what is this arena deal really? Have we really scrutinized it enough? There's a lawsuit still hanging out over the EIS and the Memorandum of Understanding. We should be hearing about that at some point. There's a lot of opportunity, I think, for people to begin sort of re-scrutinizing it. It's not that this deal doesn't have potential benefits for Seattle, but I think the trust issue is the one that shifts.
Also, it depends on the timing of what else happens. At the moment, there is no team for this group to be
right.
seeking or playing in the sandbox with exactly. I thought the Times sports columnist Jerry Brewer had an interesting take on this too. He was a little gentler than some of the others.
Right.
He didn't use the whole Karl Rove thing. He said of Hansen, he messed up big time, but let's not make him out to be some rare deviant.
Because they're all as vicious and terrible.
In other words, in that world, guess what? That's how folks play. And that doesn't excuse anything. He's merely saying
he's one of the boys.
The way they play.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to mention was the Seattle Times had an editorial this week suggesting that we should have a vote on the arena.
Yeah.
Which I think is fascinating. They haven't always been supportive of public votes on
for example, the tunnel.
For example, the tunnel. And of course, Mike McGinn was all in favor of. Well, he wasn't in favor of vote on the tunnel,
nope.
Was he? No, he didn't want. Did he want the vote?
Now everybody has to remember.
Now we're all.
We worked so hard.
I was for a vote on the tunnel.
There was that vote that didn't go his way.
And my argument.
Just by the way.
Right, yes, the
just
tunnel
by
vote
the
did
way.
Not go his way. He didn't.
Yeah.
But I guess what I'm saying is my argument was I was for a vote on the tunnel, and I thought that it would help either the opposition or the people who were in favor of the tunnel, and in fact it did work that way.
Mm-hmm.
It settled the issue, and so I thought it was very interesting. The Seattle Times was bringing that up because, from your perspective, that's either good public policy or it's a can of worms. But either way, it suggests that the path forward on the arena is open to question.
Well, it's also open to question because the environmental impact statement draft is for three different sites. One of them is the preferred Chris Hansen site, but one is the site of the, I think, the Key Arena, and then there's a third site. So this still isn't, nothing's final.
It would be impossible at this point to have a yes or
no arena vote. Yeah,
it would be a very odd multiple choice situation.
Yes, I like column A, but not B.
But for our other stadiums, there were votes. Now, one of them is extremely controversial, the baseball one, because the
because it didn't go the right way.
Within point something of yes, and then the legislature met later and considered a different proposal and went the other way. But,
Well, we have that. That's a whole other subject. How do we vote on these things? We're talking over the week's news. Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Knute Berger are here. I'm Marcy Silman. And we'll move on from basketball to just an interesting meeting. The King County Labor Council met this week to try to decide who they were going to endorse in the Seattle mayoral race. And they chose no one or none of the above, or we can't make a decision.
Yeah, so they still have the opportunity at a September 19th meeting to come up with a single endorsement, because the other way is this works is that they're not endorsing either. This happened once before, 2001 with Paul Schell, that they didn't endorse an incumbent. But so if you're Ed Murray and people are calling you the establishment candidate, this is a good deal, because if you can get the unions not to go the other way.
Well, it seems like half the unions are going for one candidate, a certain type of union, and the other half are going half for the incumbent, half for the challenger. And I think that they're still. What does it mean if the Labor Council itself endorses? I mean that the individual unions are free to endorse without the council's overriding.
My understanding, and I could be wrong about this, is the individual unions can do what they will, especially if the Labor Council doesn't. But the Labor Council sort of marshals quite a bit of emphasis and
person power,
that phone banking that's so key in some of these elections. And so they will both be hustling that until that next meeting. So,
I think it's just Seattle is not going to elect an anti-labor mayor. I can make that prediction right now.
You are.
I don't.
You are because
isn't that
because
great
they
as
both
a pundit?
Have.
No, both of them are pro labor, but they have their different flavors. They're different stands on issues that appeal. There's the whole foods group and some of the more activist unions that represent the grocery workers or maids or whatever who McGinn has their support, and Murray has the support of other unions. So
more the transportation folks, because
right.
He's worked on gas taxes.
Because he's worked
many
on
years.
Those issues.
Yeah.
So, and the city workers.
That was interesting.
But, you know, for the Labor Council, I mean, they, you know, having to marshal a two-thirds vote for, you know, between those two, I think is, a tough choice. But it's not as if the ultimate outcome is going to be bad for labor.
Where does this living wage issue fit into all of this? I mean, the mayor got the endorsement of the food workers when he came out against Whole Foods, and that sort of made a little ripple in the conversation running up to the primary. But, I mean, right now we're seeing a lot of money pouring into SeaTac a few miles south of us. But, you know, how much traction will that issue, minimum wage, living wage, have?
Well, it's getting a lot of attention nationally, and I actually haven't heard where McGinn and Murray are on the living wage. I haven't heard just personally clear statements from both of them. That doesn't mean they're not out there. I'm just not aware of it. But there is a lot going on with this, and I would hope to see it come up in the mayor's race in a more clear way.
Well, there was the McGinn activity on the Whole Foods in West Seattle, where he protested a street vacation because he was concerned about the wages that were paid there.
You know, it's interesting. Somebody's calling for increasing the minimum wage to $15. We have, I think, one of the highest, if not the highest, statewide minimum wage in the country. There are some places that are far lower. We're talking about, you know, fast food workers walking out. And some of the places I've heard they make, you know, $2 or $3 less than what the minimum wage is.
Our minimum wage is $9.19 an hour, and it is the highest in the United States.
In the United States. It's still not a living wage. I mean, if you
you can't live on that kind of income. And I think, I think if localities want to do this, there's a risk. One of the risks is you drive businesses out, you lose jobs. But I think it's a better approach to the problem than using an alley vacation process or the land use process to try and negotiate it. And the other thing, too, is, I thought it was interesting. I think a lot of people who are, you know, Tom Douglas was in the
right
paper and in the news because he was basically saying, I don't think the law is a good idea, but I think businesses ought to do it.
But
they ought to pay better.
He was very thoughtful about that. If
yes,
you remember what he said, he said that when he first started out, that he couldn't have met, you know, the higher amount. But that as time went on and he opened more restaurants, and he was sort of thinking that that would be one way to persuade other businesses to do higher wages.
But one of the things that still hasn't happened in this state is like B&O tax, you know, reform and things that make it so hard to start businesses, especially small businesses. So that has to be, you know, ideally you would be looking at this as part of a larger structural thing, although we're gridlocked on that. So,
and I was just going to finish the thought on Tom Douglas and say that what he's doing is in fact paying his employees
$15 an hour
now.
Yeah. Now, and I think the dishwashers are up to
12.
12. So yeah. He's, but that, you know, he looked at, I mean, that's more a matter of personal conscience. I'm opening how many ever restaurants he has at this point, and I've lost count because they keep opening, and I'm making this much money. And, you know, he I think, is asking other CEOs to search their souls and tithe.
It's also actually, when you read more deeply into it, a reminder that business owners, small business owners, can be wrong. He said that he took this step now because he was so concerned that he couldn't do it earlier because of the sick leave law, which he and other people were saying was going to hurt business owners. Well, it clearly didn't hurt him, and he's now admitting he was wrong on that, and that you can have paid sick leave and pay your employees $15 an hour.
We're talking over the week's news with Eli Sanders, Knute Berger, Joni Balter. I'm Marcy Silman. We'll be back in just a minute here on The Week in Review.
KUOW, Seattle News and Information. Good morning. It's 10:40. I'm Guy Nelson. 67 degrees. It's cloudy in Seattle. We'll see some sunshine this afternoon with a high temperature of 75.
Support for KUOW comes from the Peace Health Bellingham Traverse, a multi-sport relay for solo and teams to include running, paddling, and mountain and road biking. September 21st in Bellingham. Event starts at 12 noon and finishes at Boundary Bay with Traverse Ale on tap. Registration at northwesttraverse.com.
There's another way to support public radio, the KUOW Vehicle Donation Program. Call 1-866-KUOW-CAR. Your gift will help maintain KUOW as the independent news source you rely on. 1-866-KUOW-CAR.
Cheryl Strayed lost her mother and her marriage and developed a heroin habit. She decided to do something about it, like hike the Pacific Crest Trail from the Mojave Desert to the Columbia River. It did not go as planned. We'll hear Cheryl Strayed's story today in the noon hour on KUOW. It's going to be cloudy overnight and then a chance of showers tomorrow, high 73. Sunday and Monday also cloudy with a chance of showers and highs near 70 degrees. It's 1041. This is KUOW.
This is the Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman with Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, and Katie Sewell joins us now, weekday lead
popping in.
Nice to see you. And we're here to talk about the future, Katie.
Yes. Well, I'm here to tell the good news because I've been getting a lot of emails of people worried with all the programming changes, what's going to happen to this threesome on Fridays. And the good news is that they're staying exactly where they are, 10 a.m., 10 to 11,
on
hosted
Friday.
By you. And then Steve, when he returns from his sabbatical, ongoing. So we've heard you. We're keeping it. It's going to be great.
Yay. So we're happy about that. And just whenever I look at the email, people wonder what's happening. 9 in the mornings, you're going to hear The Takeaway with John Hockenberry every day except Fridays, here and now at 10 o'clock, which is a new show from NPR that Katie and I will be pleasantly surprised about when we hear it.
We speculate that it's great.
We speculate
but we have not heard the show.
So we'll all hear that together on the 3rd of September. One more week of Best of Weekday, and we're looking forward to it.
Yeah, and then the big news is that the Weekday staff and the Conversation staff are moving together and merging into a new show called The Record, which is going to be co-hosted by you, Marcy, and Steve Scher and Ross Reynolds. And that's going to be on every weekday from noon to 2. So with fall comes great change, right?
That it is. And Katie's going off to a new mini future as well.
I know. That's the sad thing about all this is I'm not going to be here to
help you out. No, we're all coming to visit you because you're going to be in Rome.
That's great. Yeah, I'm moving to Rome for the academic year. My husband got a fellowship there, and I'm going to be doing some radio projects over there as well, hopefully. So if you want to keep in touch with me, send an email to radiokatie@gmail.com, and I'll put you on the list, and I'll send you notes.
First assignment, three new ways to make pasta.
Okay.
All right. Well,
K-A-T-Y.
K-A-T-Y. radiokatie@gmail.com. So we'll be in touch.
Yes.
And now we go back to the news. That was a piece of news. Another interesting, I guess, upcoming event is this weekend, starting tomorrow, I believe, in Spokane, state Republicans, 117, am I right?
Yeah, I saw that number too.
117 Republicans are gathering in Spokane to choose a new leader of their party.
I'm voting for Pam Roach.
That's funny.
And you might be the only one.
Pam Roach
of Auburn, a longtime state lawmaker with a colorful past.
Colorful.
And
yes.
Present. did she officially say that she's running?
She never did. She just is sort of playing around with it. She's obviously having herself a very jolly time by getting herself at least a few minutes on the mic at this event as a potential possible candidate. But I think that she's got a little bit of trouble here because she wasn't officially listed as a candidate. But she apparently wants to say something. And this, you know, normally, you know, you get a new party chair. It's not that big a deal. Of course, you have to vote for it. But this one is so interesting to folks because the way that the candidates who have said that they're running is they're discussing the very wither the Republican Party.
Exactly.
What should we be? How strong? How conservative? How moderate? And so Pam Roach will definitely be the you know, one of the better video clips.
So who wants to describe Pam Roach for listeners who don't know who she is? Eli, you describe Pam Roach.
The pistol packing, sanctioned by her own party, intransigent, incorrigible, unpredictable.
Who moved my flowers? What about who moved my flowers?
Yeah. Google Pam Roach and who moved my flowers, and you'll get a great speech that she delivered on the floor of the Senate, I believe, in Olympia. And she represents Enumclaw?
Auburn, South King County, Southwest King County, I think. One of the questions I have is, I mean, she's always colorful. There would be a lot to come out of her chairship of the Republican Party, but is she really sort of executive material?
Well, her own party, I think, has said no. They pushed her out of the caucus last session or a session ago, then let her back into the caucus when it became convenient to get enough votes on something that they wanted to push through. So, no, but she's great material for writing.
She sure is.
So that's why she gets my vote.
That's why the journalists vote, yeah. Uh-huh.
And ours don't count.
No.
As far as I know. How does this work? Who are these 117 people?
They're from the various counties.
So there's three per county, I think.
Yes. And so they get together and they vote sometimes a couple of times till they get to the right number to get the person to be their pick. I would just say that, you know, over the years I've talked to Pam Roach, and whenever she calls up, it's almost like she's laughing, but she's serious, and she has some sort of at least colorful or wild proposal. And I just always sit up straight and listen.
Well, she's replacing a very colorful chair. Kirby Wilbur was
absolutely a
colorful and, quote,
worthy. He needed
worthy.
An editor. That person needed an editor for some of the
things. Well, he was lively. But you mentioned, I'm not sure if it was you, Eli, or if it was Joni, that this is really about the future, what direction the party will go in. And some of the other four people that are going to be, that I know of, that are on this ballot, I don't know actually how you get onto the ballot, are either very, very, very conservative, or Susan Hutchison has maybe positioned herself as a sort of King County moderate.
You know, I was just thinking it is a referendum on where the party is going, but it will tell us a lot about where the party in the state actually is, because the electors will say whether they are people who represent this, you know, perceived more rabid wing of the party that's not going to tolerate a Susan Hutchison, say, who they see as being too urban and moderate and in maybe the Rob McKenna mold, and are going to look for someone who, you know, they think is going to bring the party back to relevance by being more extreme than it has been on a number of issues that they think Rob McKenna was too wishy-washy on.
Knut, where do you put your money?
Well, I don't have
you have no money.
I have no money, yeah, and no candidate. The state party chair, I mean, apart from ideology, you need somebody who's going to be a bulldog. Mm-hmm. And the state party chairs often are kind of quote machines. Dwight Pell's the Democratic Party.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you get somebody, that person, you might say they have to be the Steve Ballmer of their party in the sense of, herding the cats, but also kind of marshaling messages that can work statewide. And, of course, that's the challenge as the state population has drifted more blue. And the state Republican Party, the reddest wing of the party has gotten strong, and it's been strong in the past. I mean, the state went for Pat Robertson back in the day. So, the problem is for the whoever the chair is having a message that will and an operation that will work on behalf of candidates across the spectrum within the party.
When was Jennifer Dunn party chair? Before she went to Congress,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yes.
So this is a party that's trying to get back into the game. There is only one statewide elected official who's a Republican, and that is Kim Wyman, the Secretary of State. Indeed, she's the only statewide elected official on the West Coast, as it turns out. So this party needs to find someone who can recruit and groom candidates so that they can get statewide folks elected. They need to develop the bench of folks who can run for these offices, because you don't just come from, you know, sort of local government and just rise like that. And so they really have to be very careful who they pick, and if this person can, smash the whip here sometimes and make sure that things don't get out of control with this raging debate within the party of who's in control and what kind of message they want to send out.
Do you think that red wing of the party can muster candidates that will carry the heavily populated blue portion of the state, i.e. the Cascade Corridor over here?
I think we've seen the answer already. It's
no.
So in statewide election after statewide election.
So if they're looking to take offices, don't they just ipso facto need to be more purple?
This is ipso facto is not on the minds of some of the people who are making this vote. They are thinking what I was just saying a minute ago, that the problem is they haven't been extreme enough.
Yeah, that's when parties go through metamorphoses. That's one of the issues: is do you broaden or do you go to one extreme? But candidate recruitment is going to be crucial, because if they get in a position where they're running Tea Party candidates, in Pugetopolis, and that's all they have to offer, I think they will run into problems. So they're going to have to. Be more moderate. I think one of the things from a larger sort of state perspective, and I don't know whether any of the current candidates would address this, I think one of the problems with this Republican Party right now, it's national as well as statewide, is they have no urban policy. The America is an urbanizing country. That's where the people are going. You have, Michael Bloomberg. I mean, Chris Christie, you have
They're urban.
Yes, yeah. You have a few, but they are struggling even. I mean, Bloomberg's out of the party and Chris Christie is kind of a unique situation. But here you don't hear Rob McKenna and others speaking to issues beyond maybe transportation, road building and that kind of thing. And I think that's going to limit them. And if the party ends up with a very kind of ex-urban and rural focus, I think that's going to limit their growth.
Well, here's where the action is. It's in the suburbs, the Puget Sound suburbs. Something like, Snohomish County is a good example. Mm-hmm. This is the bellwether county and a couple of the governor's races. You have to be able to talk to voters in these suburbs. And so that's the tricky dance between the rural part of the party and these suburbs. That's what's so challenging, and that has been challenging, to find a candidate who can win statewide who talks to both groups
well. And the problem there is the suburbs aren't your parents' suburbs.
Right.
The suburbs have shifted because of the employment base and that kind of thing. They're bluer than they used to be.
Well, that brings us to something that we touched on last week, which was the Bellevue City Council and the sort of changing focus of Bellevue as a very much burgeoning city. Don Davidson, who is a longtime council incumbent, decades, right, on the council,
yes,
finally conceded, and he is throwing his backing to Vandana Slaughter, who just edged him out. Running against Lynn Robinson, who got a huge amount of the vote. Vandana Slaughter was self-funded. She had a lot of money. She's a tech executive. But either way, either of these women running now is going to make a majority on that Bellevue City Council that is thinking about Bellevue as an urban place.
More transit-oriented.
Transit-oriented place that will have a center core that's going to attract people and younger people, Microsoft, maybe single people, in which it really hasn't been.
More density, more ethnically diverse. Bellevue is very diverse, and it is a growing city, and now very clearly it's going to have a different flavor, shall we say, for the council than it has been in the last few years, which has been tussling heavily over light rail. Where does it go? How much of it? The whole bit.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch Bellevue really. Besides the beautiful big buildings, of which there are many, you can see them from all over, just like you see Seattle skyscrapers. But it's now more than buildings. It's the thought and the planning and the layout and the vision as a city that has transformed.
Yeah, and that's been a long-term process. It's been carefully orchestrated, not always successfully implemented. It's in part driven by the tech sector. And we've talked before on the show about the transformation of the Bell-Red Corridor. Downtown Bellevue and Microsoft are these two pivotal places. The Bell-Red Corridor, of course, connects them, and there are major urban developments happening at both ends of that corridor, as well as light rail planned for there. So the Bellevue City Council is in a position where they have to be looking the transformation of Bellevue has already taken place. It's a big city. It's diverse. It's got lots of downtown Bellevue, lots of single people, lots of empty nesters, lots of dogs.
Just like Seattle.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it is making that transition. It may not be everybody's dish of tea, but it's the right dish of tea for a lot of people who are moving to the area. And so you have to project out from that and say, well, what is the city going to be, you know, over the next 20 years? I think that's what's going on.
And that GOP chair is going to have to think about it because it's no longer in your pocket.
Bellevue.
Yeah. Just in the last minute or so, there was a picture of the Seattle Seahawks quarterback Russell Wilson and his lovely wife in Cary Park, a picture that's going to be in GQ magazine. And, you know, it's good. He should not hide his light under that helmet anymore. They should just put him out. He had a beautiful sweater on. So he's not on the cover, but, you know, apparently he has a big spread in the actual magazines. What are they, like, scouting for the handsomest quarterback in the league? I don't know.
They found a very handsome sweater to put on.
He looks good.
I was going to say, those were some sweaters.
Okay, so we want you all, to check it out. Both of them, handsome couple.
You know, the Seahawks are starting the season in a position they have hardly ever been in, which is probably never been in the sense that they're Super Bowl favorites. Russell Wilson is a national phenomenon as somebody who's getting the focus of national profiles. The fact that he's in GQ,
and he's supposed to be a nice guy, but we heard that about Chris Hansen too. So you know, who knows? We just scratched the surface of that turtleneck. And yes, they are picked to win the Super Bowl. So who knows? A sports town at last. Well, that's kind of it. We've run out of time, folks. So I know that they'll be Knut is heading out to the great outdoors. Knut Berger-Moss back at crosscut.com. We will see you after Labor Day, a week after Labor Day. So have a great vacation. Eli Sanders, associate editor for The Stranger. Joni Balter, assistant political editor at the Seattle Times. We'll see you next week live at the same time, 10 to 11 on Fridays here on KUOW Seattle. I'm Marcy Silman, our show produced by Jason Pagano. Have a great weekend.
It's 10:58. This is KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. Good morning. I'm Guy Nelson. 68 degrees, mostly cloudy in Seattle. We'll see some sunshine this afternoon with a high 75 degrees. President Obama today called the apparent gassing of hundreds of Syrian civilians a big event of grave concern, but he stressed he was in no rush to embroil Americans in a costly new war. We'll find out more about that in the news headlines in a couple minutes.
These grandmothers don't play bingo.
Here we go, ladies, play ball. Good luck to both sides.
And they don't always play nice.
They are fierce. They are ferocious. And it's so much fun. This is so much better than TV.
The girls of summer on the softball field.
Come on, Elaine. Don't hit like a girl.
Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
They sound like fun. That's on All Things Considered, which starts at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Support for KUOW comes from Roadside Attractions, presenting In a World, Lake Bell's debut comedy about a woman breaking into the all-male world of movie trailer voiceovers. Stars Lake Bell and Dimitri Martin in theaters now. To the Point with Warren Olney coming up next on KUOW. Later today, we'll find out who is the real Nancy Pearl.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.